You know, I had a wonderful thing happen to me. For years, I have thought that I had a receding hairline. And I found out this week that that wasn't so, because I was walking through an airport and a kid said, "Daddy, Daddy, why does that man have such a tall face?" Well, what a relief to know I'm not losing my hair. You know, isn't that good? Oh, boy. One of the major political parties has taken off after the candidate of another major political party by asking a rhetorical question, which is, where was George? Have you seen that on television? Unless you've been on the moon, you have seen them asking that question. Where was George? I think that we might steal a page from their book and ask, as we study the life of Joseph and see the misery that he's been put through, where was God? Where was God all this time while Joseph was going through all the things that he's had to go through just this far in our study together in the life of this great man of God? We have seen that life is unfair. There's a general notion being mooted abroad that life is supposed to be fair. But as Christians, we study this book and we find out that it's not. Unfairness leads to all kinds of mistreatment. And we have seen some of the mistreatment that Joseph has had to undergo as God continues his training and allows the unfairness of life to be an instrument of that training. But we're going to see some more examples today, because following Joseph's being falsely charged with attempted rape, he's fired and loses his job and is thrown into jail. Now, this morning I'd like to look just at one question with you as we go through this 40th chapter of the book of Genesis together. And that question is, both for Joseph and for ourselves, where was God? Let's look at Genesis chapter 40. And before we go there to the 20th verse of the preceding chapter, chapter 39, Joseph's master Potiphar, you recall from last week, has come home, and the wife of Potiphar, who has been after Joseph perhaps for years, finally having become outraged at his resisting her advances, she charges him falsely with attempted rape, and the husband in the family, who happens to be the captain of the Pharaoh's guard and a very powerful and influential man, fires him on the spot, doesn't cut his head off, but he sends him to prison. 39:20. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. Then drop down to chapter 40, verses 1 through 4a. Sometime later, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their master, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the same prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard assigned them to Joseph, and he attended them. Just kind of by way of introduction, as we read through this passage, a few simple things strike us. The first thing I want you to notice is the roller coaster life that Joseph has been allowed to lead by the Lord. First, he's born into a wealthy and influential family in the land of Canaan. He is the great-grandson of the man who founded the country. His father, Jacob, is probably the wealthiest man in the country. He is pampered. He is given every kind of privilege. He lives a wonderful life from the human point of view for the first 17 years of his life. And then his jealous brothers turn on him, assault him, decide instead of killing him to put him in a pit. So he goes from the high of being the pampered son to the low, literally, of being in a pit. Then he is rescued from the pit. Notice the imagery of being picked up again. Rescued from the pit, but he's not rescued in order to be restored to his father. He's rescued to be sold to slavers. So down he goes again. Literally, down into Egypt. Another beautiful word picture. Down into Egypt. He is bought by Potiphar, and he is elevated to be the steward in Potiphar's house as a consequence of his diligence and his intelligence and his hard work. And things are going pretty well for him. And then he's unfairly accused of a crime he didn't commit. And he is dropped down again into the dungeon. He's up, he's down, he's up, he's down. Sometimes we think that that God allows uncertainty in life because if life were predictable, we would learn to rely on life instead of relying on God. But we have to be careful that we don't misinterpret that. I was seeing a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon this past week, which my son David has introduced me to, which is now taking up all of my leisure time reading Calvin and Hobbes. And in the cartoon, Hobbes the tiger says to Calvin the little boy, "Is there a God?" And Calvin thinks a minute and he says, "Well, somebody's out to get me." I wonder if Joseph mightn't have justifiably thought about that as he's raised up and as he's put down. Well, Christians have learned that life is a roller coaster ride, and we don't expect smooth sailing, do we? The second thing I noticed just as we begin is there's something important that's said in this passage about faith. Look back again in chapter 39, the 23rd verse. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. The same thing happened to Joseph in the dungeon that happened to him in Potiphar's house. His qualities immediately came to the attention of the senior man, and the senior man gave him responsibility. Joseph did such a good job with that, he gave him more responsibility. And before you knew it, Joseph was running the prison from the inside of the dungeon. Remarkable. The warden had great faith in Joseph. And as a result of that, what happened? He paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, made him responsible for all that was done there. Seems to me there's a principle operating there, which is this. Faith brings you freedom. Faith brings you freedom. The warden, because he had faith in Joseph, was freed from all kinds of responsibilities in connection with the administration of the affairs of the prison. You notice, by the way, that God's principles work in the lives of pagans just like they do in the lives of believers. He makes his rain to fall, what? On the just and the unjust, doesn't he? What about faith brings you freedom? What kind of an illustration could we use for that? How about an elevator? Faith in an elevator and the power of that elevator gives you freedom from having to climb the steps, doesn't it? Now, you have to use that faith correctly. I heard a story the other day about an older man and his old wife with their young child who went to town from the country for the very first time, never seen anything modern. And one of the first buildings they walked into had an elevator in it, which he had never seen before. All he knew was that the door continued to open and close. And he saw the door open and an old woman step in. He had left his wife in the car. His little boy was there with him. The door closed, and a minute later, a beautiful young woman stepped out. And he turned, he said, "Boy, go get your mama." Now, that's misplaced faith in an elevator. But the right kind of faith in an elevator will free us, because it frees us from the drudgery of climbing steps. Well, if faith in the power of an elevator can bring us freedom, think what faith in the power of a living God could do. I think God leaves these little illustrations all around. And you can almost hear St. Peter up there saying, "Oh, they missed that one, Lord, but there are two more in the pathway today." Faith brings freedom. Freedom that Paul was talking about when he spoke of the glorious liberty of the sons of God. It's marvelous to see the great freedom and liberty that faith gives us. Well, I also see that since life is a roller coaster and that faith brings freedom, God seems to use little things to accomplish great ends. Do you see that he takes the baker and the cupbearer, that's the wine taster to Pharaoh. And those are not really important people. They're around the king, all right, but so what's the big deal about the Pharaoh putting those little people in prison? Well, God's going to use that. God uses little things to accomplish great ends. Fit of anger, he puts his wine taster and his baker into the pokey alongside of somebody else who just happens to be there. And great things are going to come of that. Napoleon said, in affairs of magnitude, I've learned that in the last resort, everything invariably turns upon a trifle. Isn't that good? Now, if you men don't think that's true, try forgetting your wife's birthday. And you'll see right away what Napoleon had in mind there. God uses little things to accomplish great ends. He really does work in mysterious ways, God does, doesn't he? And there's a principle, I think, that emerges from God's using little things to do great works. And that is, if you are certain you have God figured out, you can be certain that you don't. Because he's going to do it in a way that's going to surprise you. Well, finally, not only is life a roller coaster, and Christians have learned not to expect smooth sailing, and not only is faith freedom, God using little things to accomplish great ends, but we can also see from this passage that God often does some of his most important work in confined circumstances, where the world would least expect God to be working at all. And he frequently uses prison settings, the metaphor, of course, for confined, restricted circumstances. You would think of any number of examples out of the scripture. You could just pick two. One would be Paul and Silas. You remember in Acts when they got in trouble down in Philippi for casting the demon out of the woman who could predict the future, the slave girl. And they were thrown into prison. And you remember the story about midnight, Paul and Silas, having been stripped and beaten and thrown into jail unjustly, were praying and singing hymns to God. The other prisoners were listening to them. Suddenly there was such a violent earthquake, the foundations of the prison were shaken. All at once the doors flew open and everybody's chains came loose. The jailer woke up, figured he probably would. And when he saw the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself because he thought the prisoners had escaped. And Paul shouted, "Don't harm yourself, we're all still here." Well, now you've got to imagine what it must have been like for that jailer. He expects that he's going to be executed because his prisoners must have escaped. Nobody in his right mind would stay in prison when the doors had broken loose from their hinges and all of the chains had collapsed. And instead, here these people are still praying and singing songs and saying, "Don't harm yourself." He says, "I've been in the prison business for 25 years and I've never seen anything as weird as this." The jailer called for lights, rushed in, and fell trembling before Paul and Silas. He then brought them out and asked, "Men, what must I do to be saved?" He saw the power of God at work in those constrained, constricted circumstances. Of course, he and all his household, the story is beautiful, goes on to say his household were baptized, and they took Paul and Silas out, bathed their wounds, gave them a meal. And the story has such a wonderful happy ending because the magistrates decided they had done Paul wrong, and so they sent word down the next morning, "You can leave now." Remember the audacity of Paul? I just have to read this to you. It's too good to pass. Paul, when they sent word that he could leave prison, said to the officers, "They beat us publicly without a trial, even though we're Roman citizens, and threw us into prison. And now you want to come and get rid of us quietly? No, let them come themselves and escort us out." What audacity! You're saying to the authorities, "No, sir, you were wrong. I'm not leaving. I'm staying here. You come tell me that you're sorry." And what happened? The officers reported this. They heard Paul and Silas, Roman citizens. They were scared. Came to release them, escorted them from prison. "Thank you very much, Paul. Be on your way. Be sure and stop in the next time you're in town." Oh, God's power works in constrained, constricted circumstances. He's got a long history of that. And of course, you remember one of the most wonderful and amusing of the incidents of God doing this very thing when he allowed Paul to be placed into prison over in Rome. And when Paul wrote his letter to the Philippians to talk about it, he said, "We are in chains for Christ. As a result, it's become clear to the whole guard, that I am in chains for Christ." In those days, the important political prisoners were chained to the Praetorian Guard. Praetorian Guard were the sons of the most influential men in the Roman Empire. Now, you can imagine what the consequences of being chained to the Apostle Paul would be for an 8-hour stretch at a time. Now, Paul, whatever else he was the guy who couldn't keep the good news to himself. And so God is looking down through history and says, I got something here that's really going to work great. I'm going to take the future ruling generation and put them nose to nose with the greatest evangelist of all time. How shall I do that? Well, I think I'll put Paul in prison, and then I'll just chain these guys to him in sequential 8-hour sequences and just let him talk to them. And here's this guy who's 20 years old. He thinks he's got a date that night, and instead he's told that he's going to go down to the pokey and be locked up to some Jew. And he sits there, and Paul says, where are you from? He says, I'm from Rome. Who's your daddy? Oh, he's a senator. Well, how do you like being? He says, man, I hate it. This is terrible being chained to you for 8 hours. And then he says to Paul, what are you doing here? And Paul said, I thought you'd never ask. Let me tell you what happened to me one day on the road to Damascus. And for 8 hours, this guy gets an earful from the guy who was personally taught by Jesus Christ himself. And all of that happens in jail, where you're not supposed to be able to do anything. They had him locked away there so he wouldn't infect the populace. Oh, God does some of his most wonderful work in those constrained circumstances. Well, roller coaster life, isn't it? We don't expect smooth sailing. We know God uses little things to accomplish great ends. Faith brings great freedom, and God is doing wonderful work in these constrained circumstances. Well, as we conclude today, I'm going to give you a little four-word summary to take home with you that I think bears directly on that, along with a real-life illustration of how that works. But let's go to the story as we look at chapter 40 of the book of Genesis and see what happens in the life of Joseph as he, as a consequence of this unfair treatment, is thrown into prison. The cupbearer and the baker have been thrown in along with him. And verse 5 says that after they've been in custody for some time, each of these two men, the cupbearer and the baker, had a dream on the same night, and each dream had its own meaning. Now, we've seen that Joseph already got in a lot of trouble by having one dream, but he's getting ready to get in a different kind of trouble by interpreting a second one. When Joseph came to them the next morning, he saw that they were dejected. So he asked Pharaoh's officials who were in custody with him in his master's house, why are your faces so sad today? We both had dreams, they answered, but there's no one to interpret them. And then Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams. So the chief cupbearer told Joseph his dream. He said to him, in my dream, I saw a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. As soon as it budded, it blossomed, and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and put the cup into his hand. Well, Joseph thought about that a minute, and then he said, this is what it means, Joseph said to him. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your position. And you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand, just as he used to do when you were his cupbearer. And that's the interpretation of the dream, but Joseph adds a P.S. to that. He said, when all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. That word literally means this hole. For I was forcibly carried off from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing to deserve being in this dungeon. When the chief baker saw that Joseph had given him a favorable interpretation, he said to Joseph, wait a minute, I had a dream too. On my head were 3 baskets of bread, and in the top basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. He's hoping to get as favorable an interpretation as the wine bearer got. But Joseph said, this is what it means. 3 baskets are 3 days, and within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head and hang you on a tree. That means to be impaled. And the birds will eat away your flesh. The third day was Pharaoh's birthday. He gave a feast for all the officials, lifted up the heads of the chief cupbearer and the chief baker in the presence of his officials. He restored the chief cupbearer to his position so that he once again put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had said to them in his interpretation. Then verse 23 closes. The chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. Well, my kids in earlier days would say, that is a real bummer. Now here Joseph has befriended two men, one of whom was destined to be restored to his position, the other who was destined to be hanged. The man whom he befriended, he asked, please remember me. The man forgot him. What kind of a circumstance was Joseph in? This is what one of the commentators has said about the Egyptian dungeons of that day. It was not a prison like those with which we're familiar, airy and well-lit and conducted by humane men. To use Joseph's own words in the Hebrew, it was a miserable hole. I have done nothing that they should put me into the hole, he said. Two or three little rooms crowded with prisoners, stifling in air, fetid with ill odors, perhaps half buried from the blessed sunshine. This was the sort of accommodation in which Joseph spent at least two long miserable years. Imagine a large, gloomy hall with no windows, paved with flags, black with filth, no light, no air, except what may struggle through a narrow grated aperture by which the friends of the wretched inmates or some pitying stranger might pass food and water, which are the sole staff of life. No arrangements of any kind have been made for cleanliness or the separation of the prisoners. All day, the weary clank of fetters around manacled feet as the victims slowly drag themselves over the floor, revolving again and again around the large stone columns that support the roof to which their chains are riveted. In some such sunless hole must Joseph have been confined. Marcia and I were in England this summer for a while, and we happened to pass by Warwick Castle, and the great tour in the Warwick Castle is to go to the dungeon. And it's a place that everybody wants to get into, and they're twice as anxious to get out. Even though you're a visitor, it is terrible. It's down under the castle. There's one high, high window. And over in one corner of the dungeon, which is bad enough, there's literally a hole. It looks like a manhole. It's about 8 feet deep. It's about this wide across. There's a grate on the top of it. And they used to put prisoners into it head first and leave them there. Well, it was something like that into which Joseph had been thrust. Wow. Joseph's unfair treatment came from four sources. First, from his family, of course. Many adults still suffer from the memories of verbal malpractice on the part of their parents, don't they? Family can be the source of some of the most grotesque unfair treatment. Second, he suffered from ill treatment from his circumstances. The world would say, this guy's having a terrible run of luck. I talked to a man last month who has lost his job. He has the possibility of another job outside of town, but he can't leave because he can't sell his house. And he's personally liable on those note payments. You talk about being hung. No job to make the note payments. No way to leave town to go to take the job to make the note payments with. Circumstances in our lives bring terrible unfairness, don't they? Family, circumstance, what about acquaintances? Joseph being unfairly accused by Potiphar's wife. And then other people, when you're unfairly accused, believe the story. So they participate in it like Potiphar's himself did. Others, circumstances, family, and then friends. Boy, that's the toughest one of all. He befriended the cupbearer, and then it says the cupbearer forgot about him. I have a friend who knows a couple. She worked to put him through medical school. And it was long and it was hard and it was tough because they didn't have any money. Got out of medical school. He established a thriving practice. And 15 years later, she doesn't even know where he is. He's found somebody younger and cuter and left her in the dumps. When a friend does it to you, somebody close, that unfairness is even tougher to take. Well, Joseph caught it from all four directions. Family, friends, acquaintances, circumstances. You know, I think if we're going to be honest, we can legitimately ask the question, where was God in all of this? If this is one of his saints, where is God while Joseph is in the hole? Chapter 39, verse 31. Let's look at 21 first. The Lord was with him. There's not a 31 in there, is there? If you've got a 31 in your Bible, see me after the class. Will you? Be divine revelation here, won't there, Ruthie?
Yeah.
Verse 21. Where was God? The Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. Oh, big deal. Joseph is in prison, forgotten by everybody, including the man he befriended, and the Lord is with him. What's the evidence of God being with him? Well, I think there are several things. First, look at verses 6 and 7 of chapter 40. When Joseph came to them, this is the cupbearer, remember, and the baker, the next morning he saw that they were dejected. So he asked Pharaoh's officials who were in custody, why are your faces so sad today? I think the first evidence that God was with Joseph was when God's with you and you're hurting, you're sensitive to the hurts of others. When God is with you and you're hurting, you're sensitive to the hurts of others. And the second point is similar to that. If God's with you in the midst of the hurt and he sensitizes you to the hurts of others, he will enable you to minister to those others. He was still God's man in spite of the fact that he was in the midst of the hurt. You see what Joseph said when they told him that they'd had dreams? He said in verse 8, do not interpretations belong to God? He didn't say, you guys stay right where you are and I'll get you an answer to those dreams. He said, wait a minute. Interpretations of dreams belong to God. Joseph had a very powerful sense, not only of the needs of others, but of God's willingness to minister to others' needs through him. The third thing I see as evidence that God was with Joseph was he told the truth. He saw the truth and he had the courage to tell it. You can imagine that the baker who was Joseph knew very well, going to be taken out of prison in 3 days and beheaded, was looking for some good news because he had just heard what he'd said to the cupbearer. But Joseph wasn't trying to curry favor. He understood that God was speaking through him, and so he had the courage not only to see the truth of his own situation, but to speak the truth to others because God was with him. Running all through this is the fourth thing I see as evidence of God being with Joseph, which is he had such a tremendous positive attitude. And if in the midst of the hurt we will adopt that kind of a positive attitude, God will do the most wonderful things in the way of opening doors that we never imagined. You see what Joseph wanted? All Joseph wanted was out. He said, when all goes well with you, he says to the cupbearer, remember me and show me some kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh. I was carried off from the land of the Hebrews. Basically, all Joseph wants to do is get out of there and go home. But God's got a much bigger plan for Joseph. He's going to make him prime minister over all of Egypt. Positive attitude will allow God to open doors that you never dreamed possible. I heard a story this week about Thomas Edison, who at age 67 already had well over 1,000 inventions to his credit, was doing well in business, had everything invested in this marvelous shop with all kinds of employees, and they were turning out products. And late one night, a terrific explosion caused a mammoth fire. And Edison's boys, who were working with him, came to see if his dad was all right, because he usually worked very late in the laboratory. And the father ran out and he said, "Boys, quick, quick, go get your mother. She'll probably never see another fire as grand as this." And so the mother came, and all the family, the employees from all around, and they fought the fire until 5 in the morning. Everything was lost. And Edison called his family and his workers together, and he said, "Around you, you see the ruins of our business. It's 5 o'clock. Go home and get some sleep and be back at 8. We're going to start over." And with that, he curled up on a table and went sound asleep. Magnificent. Magnificent. A positive attitude will allow God to open doors that you never dreamed were possible. Well, then the last thing, of course, that I see is that you'll receive the grace if God is with you in the midst of the hurt and the circumstances. You will receive the grace to believe that God is at work. Now, why is that? Because you will have been lifted up to see beyond. A father took his two little boys to a parade. And one of the little boys was one of these optimistic, upbeat kids, and the other one was a grump. And when they got to the parade, it was really crowded, and the father could just see, but the kids couldn't. So he picked one little boy up and put him on his shoulder, the optimist. And he said, "Come on to the other one. I'm going to pick you up too." And the other one said, "No, I'm staying down here." The boy that he picked up was able to see beyond. When the other little boy got home, his mother asked him what he saw. He said, "Nothing but big people's knees." Lifted up to see beyond. I think that's the way it was with Joseph. You remember the words of the great old hymn, "Perverse and foolish oft I strayed, and yet in love he sought me, and on his shoulder gently laid, and home rejoicing brought me." That beautiful picture of God as the shepherd. Do you know what it's like to see the view of life from God's shoulder? Oh, it's a completely different perspective than the one you'll get from down on the ground looking at the knees of the world. Lifted up so he could see beyond. I think it was like that with Joseph. Well, your hurt is probably in a different package. There won't be many people here this morning who have spent a lot of time in a dungeon last week. But if you've got a few miles on you, you have seen the truth of the four things that we noticed as we began. One, that life is a roller coaster, and as Christians, we really don't expect smooth sailing. Second, there's great freedom in faith. God does use the little things to accomplish His great ends. And then, of course, His best work is frequently done in confined circumstances. We began by asking the question, where was God in all of this? And I think we can legitimately see a real life illustration of an answer to that question. And I want to share with you something that happened to me just this week to help me understand that in Joseph's life and in mine. Prisons are pictures of confinement, of restriction, of loss of freedom, pain. There's another picture that if you haven't had the experience, you either will have or someone very close to you will have. Not a prison, but a hospital. Hospitals are also places of confinement and places of hurt and pain. I was in a hospital this week as a visitor. Room 642 of Methodist Hospital. Bendito's room. And Jim Rath and Ken Wynn and I walked in, and there was Ben sitting up eating breakfast. And it reminded me of that poem, The Cremation of Sam McGee. You remember, they open the door to see if the guy's cremated, and there he is sitting there looking great and telling, please close the door, you're going to let in the cold. There's Ben. We expect to see him stretched out in the bed. And instead, he's sitting up there with a big grin on his face eating eggs. And he said, in response to the question, how are you doing? He said, this is great. Eggs aren't even on my diet. You know, if my real doctor found out that I was eating all this cholesterol. Said, Ben, what happened to the tubes? Took them out yesterday. How you feeling? Oh, doing great. We had a prayer together, and it was a wonderful experience for us to pray with Ben. Ben prayed the last prayer, getting the last word as usual. And you want to appreciate that Ben has now got more of his insides on the outside than he's got left on the inside. And he's also got a little session with chemotherapy coming up here over the next several months, which if any of you know anything about, it's not any fun. In his prayer, he only referred to himself one time. He referred to his little problem, he said. My little problem. And I said to myself, There was something that I noticed about Ben. Two things. One, did I see despair there? Did I see discouragement and defeat? Nope, didn't see that. I saw courage, and I saw hope, and I saw great trust in the Lord. Right in the middle of the unfairness of cancer and confinement in that hospital room. Now, why is that? Well, because like the little boy at the parade and like Joseph in prison, Ben has allowed the Father to lift him up so he can see beyond. See beyond the pain and beyond the hopelessness and beyond despair. One other thing that I noticed, and that was Ben's eyes were shining. Now, Ben's eyes shine a lot anyway, but I just noticed a particular glimmer in that eye when we were there in that hospital room, and I wondered about that. I think that God allows life's unfairness to wear away everything that's on the outside so that the character of Christ that He has been building into our lives shines through. And since the eyes are the window of the soul, I understood more fully than I believe I ever have what the Apostle Paul meant, Apostle John meant in his gospel when he said, speaking of Christ, Christ is the light that shines in the darkness. And the darkness has not overcome it. In the middle of the pain. Well, where was God 4,000 years ago while Joseph was hurting? Oh, he was right there in prison. Where was God last Tuesday morning while Ben was hurting? Room 642, Methodist Hospital. Praise God for that. Father, we thank You this morning for the life of Joseph and for the light that it sheds on our own today. Each of us has his own needs, Lord, which perhaps he shared only with You, each his own hurts. We thank You for the way You minister to us right in the middle of that, Lord, and we ask You to help us to allow You to lift us so we can see beyond. In Jesus' name, amen.